Hello and welcome. I'm Mark Winkworth. You're listening to Tales of the Sea. Today's topic is an aquatic creature that has been on the planet since the Cretaceous period. Now, that's about 145 million years ago. Indigenous tribes in the state of Maine were catching and consuming this tasty fin fish in the local rivers and streams for thousands of years, using handmade traps that predate the pyramids at Giza. Yep, we're talking about the creature commonly known as the eel. In ancient Egypt, eels were associated with the sun god Atum, because Egyptians believed eels came to life spontaneously when the sun warmed the waters of the Nile River. Eels were mummified and offered to Atum in temples and then buried in cemeteries. Eels are a catadromous species, meaning that they spend most of their lives in fresh water, only returning to the sea and salt water to propagate. Pliny the Elder of Rome believed that the offspring of the eels sprang from the skin shed by adults as they rubbed their bodies on riverbed rocks. Others thought eels came from within the entrails of the earth because they didn't seem to have any regular mating patterns. Interesting critters, definitely. Although Danish biologist Ernst Johannes Schmidt is credited in 1920 with discovering that the Atlantic eel migrated to the Sargasso Sea, it wasn't until 2022 that the spawning grounds for this mysterious, elusive, and some would add tasty creature were confirmed. Or so we think. Okay, at this point I risk stealing the thunder, not to mention spoiling the fun, of reading my next guest's latest work of nonfiction. My guest today is Ellen Ruppel Schell. She's a professor in the Department of Journalism at Boston University, where she co-directs the graduate program in science journalism. She's the author of hundreds of articles and essays and is a longtime contributing editor and correspondent for The Atlantic magazine. Her commentary has appeared in The New York Times, The Guardian, The LA Times, and The Washington Post. And she's the author of four other books translated into more than a dozen languages. But today we're going to be talking about her latest work, Slippery Beast, A True Crime Natural History with Eels. I wanted to know from Ellen why she thinks folks have such a visceral reaction to the eel.
My first reaction to finding out that we're eels in our little lake in Maine completely freaked me out. And I didn't realize at the time that they're nocturnal animals, that they don't bite humans, all these kinds of things that we're, you know, frightened of. We're very frightened of the unknown. And because of their snake-like, muscular, tenacious morphology, it's very scary for many people to encounter them. And then there's so many myths about eels that people misunderstand them. And I certainly did.
A small confession. It didn't occur to me until I read the book and I thought, oh my God, when I was a kid, my best friend Nikki and I used to go out late at night. I think our parents didn't even know we were out. We'd take a little rowboat out into Manhasset Bay and we would take big flashlights, you know, and we had pitchforks.
Yeah.
And we would go hunting eels.
Good for you.
Well, we were building this aquarium in his basement. Right. And I don't know what got into us. We were like, yeah, let's go get some eels. And you'd shine a light down and you'd see an eel come up and, you know, you'd stab it. And I think, now that I've read the book, I think what we were doing was killing this eel's chance to fulfill its life mission.
What you were catching there were undoubtedly silver eels going back to mate. So they're in their last stage of their life. They only mate once or maybe twice in their life. So you're absolutely right. If you're getting eels in the ocean, and you won't see them beyond the continental shelf because they disappear. If you were close, obviously relatively close to shore. And so, yeah, you were interfering with their life cycle for sure.
Thanks for confirming that.
Right.
I got right in the middle of their life cycle.
You did.
Their final journey to meet their mating partners. And who knows how old they were? They could have been really old.
They could have been up to 40 years old, 50 years old, if they really big ones. And they're females most likely as well, if they were big.
Oh, boy.
Forgivable. You were a kid. You got to let yourself off the hook on
Well, I'll try.
Well, you know, at that time, I don't know what year that was, but eels were in abundance, you know, 30 years ago or 40, you know, okay. So they were in abundance. So it's really become an issue, you know, over the last 30 years, right? So prior to that, eels were one of the most abundant freshwater fish in many ecosystems.
I read somewhere that they may have been served at the original Thanksgiving.
Well, if you're talking about the American eel, then you're talking about Native Americans.
Right,
and,
right, exactly.
In the Maritime Indians, eel was an incredibly important food source. In some cases, the eel was really all they had to survive through the winters, because they what they do is they'd spear them in the fall. And yes, they would do pretty much what you did.
Ooh.
They would go out into canoes and they would have torches that would attract the eel, and they would spear them, or they would use baskets to catch them. They're, you know, they're eel traps, that, or they build weirs to catch them. Or in some cases, you mentioned the pilgrims and the first, you know, Thanksgiving feast. What is for sure is that the Indians, as they tend to call themselves here, at least in Maine, because I spent a good deal of time with some Passamaquoddy tribal members who are eel fishers, these folks would tread the eels up with their feet. They would go out at night barefoot, right, and go into the rivers where eels would be burrowed in the mud, and they'd stamp their feet and catch them. And the Native Americans showed the pilgrims how to do this.
Uh-huh.
So again, very, very important food source for Native Americans, the Maritimes Native Americans. So that would be Canada and New England. The eel was big deal, partially because you could salt it and smoke it and preserve it, right? It's a very fatty fish, very high in calories, very nutritious fish, a lot of vitamin A. So it was an essential food.
Today, you say, well, this was such an incredible food source. What happened? We rarely see it in the market or in restaurants in this country.
Well, first of all, there are three really species of commercially viable eel, right? Eel that most of us buy in the Northern Hemisphere in particular, the Japanese eel, the European eel, and the American eel. In the case of the American eel, it has declined by about 50% since its heyday in the 1970s. The Japanese eel and the European eel has declined by about 90%. They're both critically endangered. The American eel is not considered endangered under the Endangered Species Act, but many scientists are worried about that. It's threatened, but it doesn't have the protections of the European or the Japanese eel. And so for various reasons, as I outlined in the book, it's very complicated. American eel is not grown up in the United States. American eel that is caught, for example, in Maine as an alver, as a baby eel, is shipped to China to be grown up in fish ponds in China. There are about 1,000 fish farms in China that grow eel.
Right. So I just want to clear on this point. Baby eels are caught in Maine, shipped to China to mature, and then
once they're of market size, which is about a pound, they ship it back to the United States. It's a crazy supply chain that, as I point out, costs the state of Maine, for example, which has the only significant baby eel fishery in the United States, it costs the state of Maine a good deal, because much of the value of that fish is captured abroad in China. Also, it's not, you know, in terms of health effects and, you know, questions of how that eel is grown up in China, that is a big black box as well.
Meaning how they're raised, what they're eating, what kind of water they're inhabiting, how they're being handled, and so on.
Some people have some real issues with that.
Yeah, understandably, I would think. But just to clarify, the Japanese eel is now protected, you said, correct?
Yes, yes.
It's very scarce. Is that because of overfishing?
It's a combination of things. Eels, freshwater eels around the globe are under threat. The Japanese eel came under similar threats. It was overfished. Mm-hmm. Also, eels live in both the ocean and freshwater. They spend most of their life, actually, unlike most migratory fish, they spend most of their life in freshwater. Freshwater environments, as we all know, are under a lot of stress. They're not as clean as they used to be. They're not as, you know, free-flowing as they used to be. There are dams that interfere with migration of eels. There are all sorts of things that have an impact. But you're right about Japan. They eat about 70% of the cultivated eel. They are very, very dedicated to the eel and to the eating of eel. They have temples to eels. They have eel celebrations. It's a very big deal in Japan. Japanese eels are preferred in Japan, but because they're so scarce, the European eel originally was a substitute for them. Then it became illegal to export the European eel out of the EU. That left the American eel as the eel that the Japanese could access. They didn't like it as much, but they accept it. So the market for American eel has skyrocketed.
And that's where things get really interesting. But before we go there, you'd mentioned that you were fascinated by the subject of eels for a number of years before you started writing Slippery Beast.
Many years ago, when we bought our place in Maine, we were visited by a neighbor who first informed me that our lake that our backyard spills into was, as she put it, full of eels. And I was both terrorized and fascinated by that. 10 years later, I hired a man in the book, I call him Sam, a handyman, to work on our house, do some repairs that were much, much needed. And as I say in the book, Sam was not an enthusiastic handyman. Sam would come in, miss many days of work and come in late and leave early. And many days he would come into my kitchen and tell me stories. Well, I'm a sucker for stories. And he told me about how much he would like to buy a boat for and teach his grandson how to fish. And I said, well, Sam, you know, it doesn't seem you love home repair. Why don't you mix business with pleasure, get yourself a fishing license to go with that boat? And he said, you know, I did do that and I would do that, except for the eels. And I said, what? What eels? What are you talking about? What are you afraid of eels? You know, here's a guy that used to, you know, he'd climb a ladder with, you know, 5 pounds of nails in a bucket. I said, you're afraid of eels? He said, oh, no, I eels don't bite. And as far as I know, and even if they did, I'm not talking about eels that are big enough to bite. I'm talking about those baby eels, you know, those elvers or those glass eels, you know, those baby eels. Since the price went through the roof, it's gotten dangerous down by the river. And I said, what do you mean the price went through the roof? You know, what are we talking here? I mean, lobster goes for what, you know, $8, $10 a pound? I mean, how much would people pay for baby eels? And he said, well, about $2,500 to $3,000 a pound.
Wow.
So I was working on a different book at the time, but that, of course, stuck in my mind. So my introduction to the eel was really through the crime aspect of it. Because the price had gone so high, there were criminal cartels all over the world who were dealing in eels. And I soon learned that the illicit trade, buying and selling of eels, was the world's number one wildlife crime. So that, for me, I'm a journalist, that was too good a story to pass up. But then I, you know, in addition to that, I'm a, you know, my background is in science journalism, and the life cycle of the eel and the natural history of the eel was absolutely fascinating as well. So those were two threads that I braided, and was a really, really fun project.
Well, the criminal and the science aspects of this story are completely fascinating. I want to roll back to your life story, if we could, for a few moments. Where did you grow up, and what are your first memories of the sea?
Well, I grew up in upstate New York, first in a place called Port Byron, which was a tiny little kind of farming village. And then we moved to the big city, which was Syracuse, New York. But I have to say, I didn't see the sea until I was about 16 or 17. I never saw it. Yeah. We're landlocked. And the first time I did was in England when I was visiting my cousins. So they took me to Brighton Beach in the south of England, and that was the first time I'd ever been to the ocean. I was mesmerized by the ocean. To me, it was kind of like a living, breathing thing, but also a little terrifying because I didn't grow up with it. I didn't know anything about it. And also, I love the show Jacques Cousteau.
The undersea world of Jacques Cousteau, of course.
So I determined to become a marine biologist.
So other than Jacques Cousteau, were there any other major influences on your career choice?
So my ninth grade biology teacher, Mr. Robinson, he did a special field class in the summer for a small number of students, six of us. And so we would do what he called research. Again, not in the sea, but we would do it in lakes and ponds and, again, the water. So for me, water was water, whether it was the sea, whether it was lake. I just really enjoyed that. Mr. Robinson got me launched.
So let me guess, after high school, you found a college or university right on the ocean, right?
I was kind of an idiot because I proceeded to pick a university that was landlocked and was unable to pursue. I did a biology degree, but not a marine biology degree. So that was the end of that.
So then college was where?
The University of Rochester.
Yeah. Landlocked. Exactly.
Totally landlocked. Yes.
Once you had decided and heard the story from that ever so gifted handyman, Sam, once you had decided to dig in, what were the things that were most eye-opening, mind-boggling to you as you got into the story, or maybe surprising?
Everything about the eel is surprising. Really, it's a contrarian animal. Everything you think is one way, the eel goes the other way. Hmm. It's one of the few fish, for example, that can swim in both directions.
Yeah, I love that.
Right?
That's crazy.
Right? It can breathe through its skin. So it can actually survive on land for a certain amount of time. You can freeze it and you can thaw it and it can still be, it's the most tenacious, durable creature you can imagine. The mysteries of the eel have haunted scholars since Aristotle, and they still do. People devote their life to this creature, which is their career, I should say, to this creature. So I was able to travel, to Europe and around the U.S. and stuff, and talk to a good number of these folks, and they are all more than enthusiastic. They're enthralled to the eel, and it's this mystery. It's been called the eel question. For hundreds of years, the question of how the eel reproduces has just haunted scientists. And the final thing I will say, it seemed to me that the natural history of the eel, the understanding, the unraveling of the natural history kind of paralleled the history of science. And that was just remarkable. Aristotle thought that eels reproduced by spontaneous generation.
Right. Life coming from nothing.
But, Aristotle was so eminent that many scholars to follow for centuries agreed with this, which to us sounds crazy, but it made a lot of sense because the eel was everywhere and no one had ever seen it reproduce. So how could the eel be everywhere? It seemed that almost everyone, Darwin, Linnaeus, all these great scientists dabbled in the eel and had their theories about the eel. All of them were wrong, by the way.
Yeah, and you mentioned in the book that even the young Sigmund Freud got involved.
Freud was 20 years old. Okay, yeah. So he's a medical student in Vienna. His advisor was a Darwinist, right? And so because of what Darwin's theories were, it was important that the eel be an hermaphrodite, have both male and female sexual organs. This was important to his advisor. Now, how are you going to find that out? Because you can't tell a male from a female eel just by looking at them, unless you go by size. So female eels tend to be bigger than male eels. He wanted to establish that eels were hermaphrodite. So he sent his student, who was Freud, to his laboratory and said, you're going to find this out. And the only way you're going to find this out is by dissecting eels and finding both the male and the female sexual organ in a single eel. They had not at that time been able to find any male sexual organs in eels. What transpired was that Freud proceeded to disembowel 400 eels.
Oh, boy.
Right? And it took him weeks and weeks and weeks. And he writes these really funny letters home to his pals about, what he's doing, because Freud was kind of full of himself.
Understandable.
And then finally, after about what is said to be 400 eels, he finally found an eel with a male sexual organ in it. He couldn't be really sure, but this was his first published paper, and he kind of kept it on the low because he did not find a female sexual organ in that eel, which meant that he did not find the mature eel to be an hermaphrodite. It was kind of a failure in a funny way. It should have been a real victory for him. So he published it, and then he kind of ran away from the paper. He never went back to this line of research again. It was not good for his resume.
Let's fast forward just a bit to another researcher, and a rather significant discovery in terms of where eels were, in fact, mating and reproducing.
You know, when you read about the eel, you're going to read about Johannes Schmidt. And he was this researcher who was married into the Carlsberg beer family. And so he had the resources, thanks to that connection, to mount expeditions to search for the spawning grounds of the eel. Mm-hmm. Again, this great mystery. He launched these expeditions as often as he could, try to follow the larva of the eels.
Presumably from the spawning grounds, correct?
Let me explain this. I have to back up just a little bit here to explain this. The eel life cycle is in five different stages. You know, you have the fertilized egg, and then you get the larva that comes from that egg, okay? Mm-hmm. So the larva then goes from the salt water where the eel is spawning to the coast, which is quite a journey. It'll take anywhere from a year to two or three years, depending on whether it's the American eel or the European eel. Mm-hmm. And again, I'm just talking about the Atlantic eels,
right,
okay, the
right.
American and the European eel. Then as it approaches a coast, it changes from a larva, which looks like a willow leaf. It doesn't even look like an eel at all. Mm. And for many, many centuries, people didn't think it was an eel.
So at this stage, it looks like a leaf.
And then it converts to what's called a glass eel, which looks much more like an eel. It's smaller than a larva. It's transparent. That's why they call it a glass eel. And then as it approaches the shore, it becomes pigmented and it becomes an elver. And then the next stage is the yellow eel. And the yellow eel's job is basically just to eat. This is when it's either in estuaries or has actually found its way up a river into lakes like the one we have in our backyard. And it grows for as long as 40 or 50 years in the yellow stage.
40 or 50 years? That's a long time.
Until it turns around, it becomes a silver eel and makes a migration back home to its spawning grounds, where it spawns once or maybe twice and dies. So that's the path of the eel. Again, no one has ever seen eels mate, ever. So this, again, is you know, partly theory.
Okay.
No one's ever seen an eel spawn, so we're speculating on this. So in the case of Johannes Schmidt...
Oh, let me guess. He got hooked by the eel question.
And he decided he was going to follow the larva as they get smaller and smaller. So as they get smaller and smaller, that means they're younger and younger. He's looking for the spawning place. Mm-hmm. But he never actually got there. He speculated that it was the Sargasso Sea, south of Bermuda. He claimed he had actually found it, but he hadn't really found it. Since that time, scientists, they've tried to follow the eels back, silver eels, going back from their homes in freshwater back to the Sargasso. They've tried to do this with pop-up transmitters that they actually sew into these eels. It's really quite a process. The scientists I've spoken with insist that they haven't really been able to trace it all the way back to the Sargasso. It's still a mystery. They found plenty of larvae, but no eggs, no mating eels. That they were not able to do.
So the mystery goes on. And of course, the big question, how to grow eels in captivity?
Which has very much eluded scientists for decades. The Japanese eel has come close. I mean, they've managed to do it after, but it's very expensive, very difficult. And of course, if you could do that, you'd avoid all the problems of this crazy supply chain that I described before, fishing for baby eels in the United States and then shipping them off to grow in China and then shipping them back.
Right.
You'd avoid that whole problem if you could raise them in a laboratory or in a farm situation like you can with oysters and other things. But so far, we cannot do that.
Which leads us back to the question of the monetary worth of the American eel or the baby eels, the elvers. You mentioned at one point that the market price for these elvers shot up to something like $3,000 a pound. How did that explode? I mean, there obviously been, we'll talk about Maine, there obviously been fishermen, folks that have collected these crazy little glass elvers late at night under the light of the moon and sold them for many years.
So Maine is the only significant elver fishery in the United States. South Carolina has a tiny one. It gives out 10 licenses, but Maine has 425 licenses. So it's the only significant elver fishery in the U.S. And to be honest, you really couldn't give those licenses away 20 years ago. But then, as I said, after the European eel became illegal to export and the Japanese eel became critically endangered, suddenly the market for American elvers just went through the roof. That's what happened. There was also a tsunami, some people might remember, in Japan that disrupted a lot of their aquaculture and fishing. Although it did not directly impact their eel farms, it had a trickle-down effect. The combination of those two things, it changed things for the elver fishery. The only significant one in the United States was in Maine.
So suddenly, 2011, 2012, that dynamic changes in the character of a gentleman named William Sheldon. How does he play into this story?
Well, it's interesting. You know, I found out about William Sheldon, learned that he was the sort of kingpin of the elver industry in Maine. When I learned about him, he was in a federal penitentiary in New Hampshire. I called his attorney, and attorney said, he's not taking visitors. Let's wait till he gets out. And he was kind enough to give me an extensive interview. I think I was probably one of the last journalists that he would do that with. Bill is an interesting guy. He is a native-born Mainer. He interestingly has a degree in wildlife management. And so he got his start working for the Maine Department of Marine Resources as a specialist, just by coincidence, as a young man in the eel. He was doing eel surveys. And the 1970s, he went ahead and he actually wrote a 25-page manifesto on eels in Maine and the American eel. And he also developed a special eel trap called the Sheldon eel trap, which he patented. He really was and is an expert on the American eel. He became the biggest dealer of eels. I'm making a long story very short. He went into the lobster business. His lobster boat ran aground. He had some bad luck. He hooked in with a dealer from South Carolina. All sorts of things went on. He became the biggest dealer of elvers in the state of Maine. And he had a license which apparently was quite substantial, although he hasn't disclosed the quota that he has, but apparently quite substantial quota.
Just a quick side note here. The state of Maine currently issues 425 elver fishing licenses each year. Each license comes with a quota or amount of elvers or glass eels that can be caught in pounds on that license. Individual license quotas are determined in part by the amount of elvers a fisherman has lawfully harvested in previous seasons. New licenses, should they become available in any one year, are awarded through a lottery system. Last year, there were 16 new licenses available and 4,500 applications. The total quota for elvers this past season in Maine was just over 9,600 pounds. At a market price of between $1,200 and $2,000 per pound, that equates to between $11 million and $19 million. Serious money.
As his wife also had a license, his daughter has a license. So it became a kind of a family business, the elver business. Again, when the prices of elvers went up, Bill Sheldon, like so many people, got greedy. And he's the first to admit it. And he got involved in elver poaching ring that involved six states up and down the East Coast. It led to a four-year investigation by Fish and Wildlife and other agencies, and a bust in April of 2014, in which he and a good number of other people were arrested. The numbers were whittled down to 22 who were tried and convicted of illegally buying and selling elvers. That's why he ended up in the state penitentiary as a 73-year-old grandfather and highly respected expert on the American eel.
Another quick note, the conviction of Bill Sheldon and 21 others was widely publicized at the time as the largest wildlife crime in American history. Sheldon, having admitted to trafficking just over $500,000 worth of juvenile eels, also known as elvers or glass eels, as well as taking specific steps to avoid law enforcement detection, was fined $10,000 and sentenced to 6 months in prison and another 3 years of supervised release. These convictions were the result of Operation Broken Glass, a multi-jurisdiction United States Fish and Wildlife Service investigation into the illegal trafficking of American eels. Ellen, this sounds like quite a sting operation.
The helicopter chase, death threat, it was a pretty dramatic event. All the states had to do it at the same time and the same day because there were undercover agents posing as elver fishers and elver dealers. And they felt that once the cat was out of the bag, if one of them got found out, everyone else on the team would be in danger.
So where is Bill Sheldon today?
He's out, obviously. Is he back in business?
He is absolutely back in business. He's an employee of a Canadian company. That's how he's managed to continue dealing as an employee.
That would be dealing in the elver trade.
His daughter is also dealing, and his wife is a vice president of the company that employs him.
So I'm curious, are there any, I assume there must be, agencies internationally, locally, that are attempting to prevent further corruption in the industry?
Oh, sure. Interpol, Europol is a very big deal in Europe.
Bottom line, the supply can't be limitless, yeah? I mean, although there are limits on licenses, how many pounds fishermen could take every year, is there any current consensus as to the future of the American eel?
Part of the reason writing this book was to alert people to the importance of this creature. We don't know how low the population can get of the American eel before it's really truly in danger of extinction.
Right. Another important question in search of an answer. Ellen, I want to turn for a moment to the issue of eel farming in Maine and why we don't see more of it. And I know you've spent a fair amount of time with Sarah Rademacher, who is the only person in the country who's taken the dream of eel farming and built a viable business.
So Sarah Rademacher is originally from Indiana. Her father was a veterinarian who specialized in reptiles. But it was her mother, I believe, who taught her how to fish and to hunt. She grew up around animals, went to Auburn University in Alabama, studied aquaculture, and then went on to work in aquaculture in Africa, and then moved to Maine for an internship and learned more about aquaculture and got very excited about prospects of aquaculture, loved Maine, and decided she's going to stay in Maine. She cast about for what kind of species should I raise? You know, we have salmon farms in Maine, we have oyster farms in Maine, and read about the eel. She got very intrigued by it, and she learned the eels were grown up in China, and she thought this was a great opportunity. Now, it took her many, many years. It first started growing eels in her basement in a tank.
Okay.
And she finally, about 2 years ago, opened the first ever commercial eel farm in the state of Maine, and really the first ever commercially viable eel farm in the United States. And she has a quota of elvers that she's allowed to buy at a reduced price from local fishermen. And her hope is to grow up about 6% of the total supply of American eel in the United States.
So it sounds like American Unagi, that's Sarah Rademacher's company here in Maine, is off to a great start.
So far, so good. And she provides eel for some of the best restaurants in the United States.
And I want to personally thank her for that. Ellen, this has been great. You've been very generous of your time. It's an amazing story. Still mysteries to solve, of course, which I find fascinating. So just to close the loop, a few thoughts on what this project has meant to you?
I think what it gave me, it was very inspiring. This book is about eel people as much as it is about the eel. In fact, probably more about the people. And what's really inspired me is other than the criminals that are in the book, who are inspired by money, The scientists and the advocates and the people who are so passionate about this creature are in it out of curiosity and really determination to solve mystery. There's no money in this. There's not very much glory in this. It is a central question of science and natural history. And to see how many people are devoting their careers and most of their waking hours to working on this problem was a true inspiration. It was really great to be following an uncharismatic species. It's easy to see why people care a lot about the whale or about the panda. Why they care about this creature? You know, most of these people don't think they're going to nail the answer. It's the process, the journey that keeps them going. And it was really wonderful to see that.
Alan, thank you so much for your time. You've been wildly generous, and this has been great fun for me. I know that folks who listen in will have a great time and run out and grab your book, which is unforgettable. So thank you again so much for being with me today.
Thank you very much. Take care, Mark.
That ends this episode of Tales of the Sea. And the mystery remains, as it has for thousands of years, as to precisely where in the Atlantic Ocean the American eel spawns and begins its journey of many years and hundreds of miles before returning to its birthplace for its final act of procreation and death. Special thanks to my guest Ellen Ruppel Schell for her mysterious and fascinating book, Slippery Beast, A True Crime Natural History with Eels. And be sure to put Ellen's book at the top of your reading list, available online or at your favorite booksellers. This episode was produced at Munjoy Studios in Portland, Maine. Special thanks to my eyes-on, hands-on, take-no-prisoners producer, Jewel Selbo. I'm Mark Winkworth. Thanks for listening.